Next case is number 08-1265, Optium Corporation against EMCOR Corporation. Mr. Klein.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please your court, I'm Douglas Klein for Optium Corporation. We're here on a summary judgment record at the district court, and fundamentally the error that we propose is that this court should have conducted a trial on the question of Optium's declaratory judgment counterclaim, seeking a declaration that the seeking a declaration that EMCOR's patents that are at issue in this case are unenforceable. The district court did not conduct a trial. It appointed.
And you're saying the trial should have been conducted in order to find the underlying facts?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Instead, the district court referred the matter to a special master. The special master, on papers with some evidence, but by no means all the evidence that would have been presented in a trial and the opportunity to assess the credibility of witnesses, the error that the special master made was he rendered his decision, his recommendation, on the undisputed facts that he found and some consideration of his assessment of the disputed facts. He weighed those facts, which was improper.
What were your facts? What was your best evidence on
our best evidence,
intent,
Your Honor?
Not on materiality, on deceptive intent.
Our best evidence on materiality.
On materiality, on deceptive
right.
intent.
It ties in together, of course. The evidence of no witness testified. You're right, I'm sorry, I didn't submit it, I tried to fool the patent office. No witness testified to that. What the record showed was that on a reasonable interpretation of the facts available, that the inventors identified this Willems article as the closest prior art to their invention. Now, there's a dispute about that. There was an invention disclosure form that asked the question, what were the prior attempts to solve the problem?
That all, as I understand it, goes to materiality, but not to deception.
But I think,
am I wrong about that?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the judge, the mistake that the special master made and that the court adopted was in weighing the materiality, and therefore it infected his decision on intent. There was evidence upon which a reasonable fact finder could find that the reference was highly material. There was evidence that a reasonable fact finder could conclude that the inventors knew the reference was highly material. There was no credible explanation. In fact, there was no explanation at all for why the reference was not disclosed. And in that circumstances, then, the court, the fact finder, can infer intent when there's a highly material reference. When the inventor knows, and we're not talking should have known here, a reasonable fact finder could have found below that these inventors knew the reference was highly material. A reasonable reading of the facts is that they identified it as the closest prior art to their invention, and there was no explanation why it was not disclosed. The inventors said they don't know why it wasn't disclosed. The attorneys who were deposed simply said they can't recall. In an interrogatory response,
you're really asking for an assumption that it was highly material.
I'm sorry.
Well, because I was thinking, why couldn't an assumption have been made that because it dealt with only the single tone phase modulation, that it was different? I mean, in terms of, you're asking us to negate what the special master used as the premise for summary judgment.
Fair enough, Your Honor. And I think that's because on summary judgment, Optium was entitled to that assumption. Optium was entitled to the benefit of the evidence.
Well, you're not entitled to accept as true every reasonably unsupported assertion of fact. I don't know how this fact ought to be weighed. What's before us is what the special master did.
Right. There was expert testimony that that it rendered obvious claim 24 and other claims, and the special master just got that fact wrong. There was expert testimony that there were many claims of these two patents that Willems presented a prima facie case of invalidity as obvious. That was from the expert doctor.
In combination with other art.
There was also evidence, though, that there was no reference before the patent office that disclosed the specific feature of a plot of SBS threshold increase as a function of phase modulation index.
So if we accept that let's accept that it's material.
Right.
We still need to understand why intent, either that intent didn't have to be shown. I guess that's your position.
I don't think it didn't have to be shown. I recognize that it is chicken and the egg-ish, if you will. But it is dependent.
No, it's a question of precedent, which says these are separate facts.
Yes, I understand that.
Need to meet a threshold.
You need
required.
A threshold showing on clear and convincing evidence of each fact. Absolutely, I understand that, Your Honor. And here, the facts were that there was reasonable evidence that Willems was highly material. And Optium presented evidence upon which a reasonable fact finder could conclude.
Let's accept that
right.
that reasonable evidence has been shown.
Reasonable evidence that the inventors knew that it was highly material. Not just that they knew of the reference, but reasonable evidence upon which a fact finder could find that the inventors knew the reference was highly material. That invention disclosure, a reasonable reading of it is, what was the source of previous information closest to your invention? Now, EMCOR proposed a different construction of that question. The special master came up with a third construction for that question.
No, you just cited precedent. It says you have to show intent by clear and convincing evidence.
Right.
I can't say that that's a different construction of the law.
No, I understand that. What I'm saying, I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. The special master found a third construction of what this invention disclosure was asking. It seems to me that makes clear there is a dispute about that. And on summary judgment, Optium was entitled to the benefit of its reasonable proposal that the inventors knew that this was a highly material reference. They identified it as the source of previous information closest to their invention. And I do think the case law says at that point, when there is a highly material reference, when the applicants know that it's highly material and it's not disclosed, that in the absence of a credible explanation, a fact finder can then infer intent. And here, Optium did not get the benefit of disputes concerning what Willems disclosed. The special master weighed. He even said in his opinion, there's a dispute about what Willems discloses. There's a dispute about what the invention disclosure was asking when the inventors identified the Willems reference. There was expert testimony that the reference was highly material. He weighed this evidence, and he concluded himself personally, which is fair enough, that he didn't think it amounted to inequitable conduct. But on summary judgment, that was not his role. His role was to give Optium the benefit of these questions, and to the extent there are disputes, move the case forward to trial. Instead, he recommended summary judgment enter against Optium, and the court adopted that without comment, just adopted the report and recommendation without comment.
Wasn't there an absolute absence of any evidence that would explain why the prosecuting attorneys hadn't?
That's correct.
Submitted it after the inventors had given it to them?
That's right.
How do you think?
I'm sorry. They said they don't remember. And I would propose.
So there isn't any evidence of it at all. How would we get intent?
I think if at a bench trial, the court would assess the credibility of the attorney saying that they don't recall. It can't be that on a summary judgment record, a patent applicant should be able to avoid a finding of inequitable conduct by the inventor saying, I don't remember, and the attorney saying, I don't recall. I mean, EMCOR takes the position in its briefs.
But the special master, in expressing doubts even as to materiality, did discuss the different subject matter of the Willems reference and the patented invention.
He did, that's correct.
Such that, in terms of evidence of intent, the special master may very well have concluded that intent on the undisputed facts hadn't been shown, at least couldn't meet the clear and convincing evidence standard.
Right, but of course, Optium was not limited to the undisputed facts at this stage of the proceeding. Optium was entitled to have the benefit of the disputed facts as well. And there are several points in the report and recommendation where the special master makes the error of saying, on the undisputed facts, I don't find that it's inequitable conduct or that there's intent. But Optium was not limited to only the undisputed facts.
What are some of the other facts that would help?
That Dr. Catherine Hall testified, offered her opinion that there was a prima facie case that many claims were invalid, as obvious.
Expert opinion, I don't think, is a fact.
It's evidence supporting. It is evidence upon which a reasonable fact finder could rely to conclude that the reference renders invalid many claims of the patent. Dr. Hall explained that there was no reference that showed the same before the patent office that showed the same combination of elements, a plot of SBS threshold increase as a function of phase modulation index.
But
there's a fact that
no
the other expert
that,
agreed with that. Pardon me, Your Honor.
I don't recall an argument that this actually was an invalidating reference. It was entirely that it should have been cited by the applicant. Right?
Oh, I'm sorry. There was opinion testimony from Dr. Hall, an argument by Optium based on that opinion testimony, that at least claim 24 of one of the patents in suit is obvious in view of the Willems reference and a Korotke reference. Willems is about single tone phase modulation, and the claims do concern multi-tone, at least two-tone phase modulation. So Dr. Hall did not opine that Willems anticipates claim 24 or any other claim, but offered the opinion that Willems, in view of a Korotke reference, which does show two-tone phase modulation and a level of ordinary skill in the art, that a reasonable person would have found the differences between the claimed invention and Willems obvious, as a whole, obvious at the time the invention was made. So that is part of Optium's position, that the Willems reference renders claims invalid as obvious.
Where does it stand? If, in fact, the patent is not unenforceable, then your trial will proceed?
We've had our trial, Your Honor. It's a strange procedural posture, the way this has developed. The trial on liability took place in October, and the jury found infringement and not invalidity of these patents.
So you raised the issues with respect to obviousness in the trial on invalidity, and you were not successful.
That's correct. That is correct. There was, and I wasn't, that's not in this briefing. It happened after this briefing was submitted. It's not part of this current record, but there was testimony from Dr. Hall on this issue. I'm in my rebuttal time. I'm certainly happy to answer more questions if Your Honor thinks that's the best use of the time.
Do you want to pursue that aspect? Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
All right.
We'll
thank
save
you.
Your,
thank
your
you.
Full rebuttal time, Mr. Klein. Mr. Castanis.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Three of this Court's decisions answer the argument that's been made against us trying to overturn the summary judgment motion. First, this Court's relatively recent decision in AstraZeneca, which we portrayed in our briefs and which was not responded to in the reply brief, holds, and I quote, "Intent to deceive cannot be inferred from a high degree of materiality alone, but must be separately proved to establish unenforceability due to inequitable conduct." Yet, Judge Newman, when you asked my friend on the other side what the evidence was of intent, he pointed you to materiality.
Well, Mr. Klein thinks that precedent perhaps goes too far.
The precedent is the precedent of the Court, and I think it is the correct precedent of this Court, because since this Court's in-bank decisions in the 1980s, it's stressed that materiality and intent are separate inquiries. And in this case,
but there's no question. I mean, you know, it may not be your best argument to start citing precedent, because there's precedent. You know, there's a lot of precedent of that, including that while it may not, they may be separate prongs, that it can only be used, and then it's our precedent cites at least three factors, right? That he knew or should have known that it existed. So our precedent is you can never use it. It's you can only use it if you can also establish the following three criteria. Am I wrong about that?
There are cases like Faring that say that as well.
Right.
And then...
So his argument, I think, fairly under our precedent, is it not, that he meets those other three criteria?
I'm not sure that he does meet those criteria when you look at the facts of Faring and the facts of the other case. I think there was one other case,
Praxair,
yes, that set those forth. And you'll note in both of those cases that there were affirmative representations that would have been impossible to make or would have otherwise been rendered false by the submission of the omitted art or the omitted document. And what we have here also, there's another problem answered by another one of this court's precedents, again, which I hope and presume is this court's precedent, and that's the Exergen case. We're not sure, even at this stage, who the supposed bad actor is. What I heard from Mr. Klein was that the inventors knew of the materiality of this reference. But in fact, the inventors disclosed the reference in the chain through the attorneys. The only thing we know about the communication of that report of the invention disclosure to the attorneys themselves is one sentence at page A209 of the record where Logan testifies that, and I quote here, "Yes, I believe Mike," referring to Pritzker, one of the four lawyers who handled these two applications, "I believe Mike got a copy of the invention disclosures as a process of developing the patent." Well, this sentence is the entirety of the evidence that any of the lawyers knew anything about the invention disclosure. And let me just...
But the evidence is that the inventors disclosed it to the prosecuting attorneys, and I thought somehow it got lost in the shuffle. I mean, that was your argument, right? It got lost in the shuffle?
That is a much more reasonable inference on this record. That is a much more reasonable conclusion to draw.
But the question is really on summary judgment, not whether it's a much more reasonable inference, but the inferences are supposed to be drawn for the other side. So if he's got a reasonable inference and you've got a more reasonable inference, you don't win on summary judgment.
Well, I don't agree, first of all, that his inference is reasonable. I was simply trying to use the language of the third case that I was going to mention, and that's Star Scientific, which I think plays into the summary judgment standard, so that to overcome a summary judgment motion on intent, they've got to show that a reasonable fact finder could conclude that the most reasonable inference on intent, and intent is always proved inferentially, so that's what we're talking about with regard to inferences. The most reasonable inference is that the material was withheld with deceptive intent in order to deceive the patent office. You can't find that here. In fact, the case that's being made against us is that on 11-year-old records where there is little recollection and very little documentary record in possession of any of the inventors or in the possession of any of the lawyers, that somehow or another the burden should be shifted to us to disprove inequitable conduct. This is precisely the sort of this case, if inferences of this sort were allowed and that gets past summary judgment, and it can then be bootstrapped to not say only material but highly material, then every patent holder like us is going to be in the position of facing the argument that we have to prove the absence of inequitable conduct.
Well, let me step back a minute, because your answer to me on the summary judgment question was the Star Scientific and their standard that it has to be the single most reasonable inference, right? How do we play that out in summary judgment? Let's assume you have an inference and the other side has an inference. Let's assume his inference is not unreasonable, which is that the inventors claim they gave it to the prosecuting attorneys and the attorneys say they didn't have it. I mean, the inference is, you know, could be that somebody is not telling the truth and they indeed did have it. How do you play into the summary judgment standard of inferences towards the other side, this most reasonable inference? We've got inferences over inferences, right?
Well, I think you do. And I think what you have to conclude, because, again, all intent evidence, almost all of it that I can think of, is inherently inferential. What you would have to conclude on summary judgment is that a reasonable fact finder could conclude that the most reasonable inference from the intent evidence is that there was an intent to deceive the patent office. And that is not the case here. Even if Star Scientific didn't exist, you could not uphold on a post-trial record, if this is the best evidence they've got, you could not uphold the finding of intent made on this record. That's why summary judgment under Rule 56 is appropriate. And in that regard,
what if the fact finder did not believe the attorneys? Then you could on this record, right? I mean, if their credibility is brought to bear.
In other words, that the attorneys were to testify, they say, I don't recall.
And the fact finder says, I don't believe you. You're inherently incredible, and I don't believe that. Couldn't it stand?
I think that might be enough to discard that testimony. The problem is that the burden, by clear and convincing evidence, still belongs to the other side. And I don't think that simply disbelieving a denial of a charge somehow or another is clear and convincing proof of the charge itself. And I want to add, by the way, Mr. Klein made the comment at the beginning of his argument that there was other evidence that they didn't present at summary judgment. And I just want to add there that Rule 56 is, I think this court has used the term, it's a put-up or shut-up time. If they didn't put the evidence in to show that they had a case for trial in front of the judge, then I don't think that we get to hear about evidence that they could have put in but didn't put in.
Did your clients acknowledge that this was the closest prior art? Was that an undisputed fact?
It was no, not at all. In fact, I thought
the other side said that it was the closest prior art.
I didn't hear him say that. I hope he didn't say that, because what happened, first of all, the question C is, it really is two questions. And if you look at page 175 of the appendix, which is the invention disclosure, it asks actually two questions. It says, what were the previous methods or apparatus that were used but failed to solve the problem?
Some of this stuff is marked confidential in the briefs, is it not?
It is. I need to be careful there. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
thank
I mean,
you.
I was trying to be careful, but you're...
Let me just say that there is a second...
Tell us what you need to
there is a second There is a second question there in the parenthetical, and that's the only part of the question that they seize upon. Now, an important point to note also is that the invention disclosure is actually only the first few pages of this reference.
And why is that confidential, by the way, since we mentioned confidential? I mean,
I don't know the answer to this. I was not the trial counsel. I do know that it was stamped confidential under the protective order, and we've attempted to preserve those confidences.
This is a digression, but thanks to Judge Prost, we ask you both, would you take a look at what's been marked confidential in the context of everything that's transpired, and give us a fresh list, either take the briefs or whatever and mark it up so that we can figure it out. So
if we write
an opinion, we'll know what needs to be withheld.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me go back, though, to this disclosure. And the important point that I want to make here is that there's an invention disclosure, which is a form used by the company, and then it's followed by a paper that was written by Logan and Lee. And you'll note that the dates are different. The paper is dated February 97, and the invention disclosure is dated May 1997. One of the things we don't even know on this record from this testimony at A209 is whether what Logan says Pritzker got was the whole thing. And this is important, because if he only got the first part, let's say, then that bracketed one in the answer to C doesn't have any reference, because that's all the way back in the February 1997 paper that was appended to it. And in fact, when he was being asked this question, if you look also at page A209, the lawyer questioning Mr. Logan is separating the invention disclosure from the Logan and Lee paper itself. So if he only got the first few pages, he had a disclosure that had bracket one, and he could look all the way through the thing and would never find any reference to the Willems article, because it was in the Logan and Lee paper. Now, we don't know that, but let's say it was. Let's say we draw that inference, that it was attached. Now, you have to draw the inference that he was able to understand that in these apparently two separate documents that the bracket one referred to an endnote in the appended paper. Okay, another inference. Let's say that's a reasonable inference, too. Now, we have to assume that he actually pulled the Williams reference and read it. That's another inference on top of an inference on top of an inference. Then we have to conclude that he concluded that that reference was in fact material, another inference piled on. Then we have to conclude that he determined that he was not going to present it to the patent office because he wanted to deceive them, the ultimate inference. Now, FMC, this court's precedent, cited in our brief, says piling inferences on top of inference on top of inference is not appropriate for summary judgment, and it's certainly not an appropriate way to decide an inequitable conduct case. Unless the court has further questions, I'll give back the rest of my time to the court.
Any more questions? Any more questions? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Klein.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few on the confidentiality issue. Ms. Love and I were at the trial. We can work that out. Much of this information came in at trial in a public
within
forum.
About a week, would you
right.
give
we can
us
do that.
An advised
Absolutely. Claim? With respect to, EMCOR takes the position that the inventors disclosed Newman. They've said, well, they disclosed it. Well, if they disclosed it at all, which they never disclosed it to the patent office, at best, they disclosed it to the attorneys. EMCOR can't credibly say, well, the inventors disclosed it, but that the attorneys then say there's no evidence that the attorneys ever got it. They can't have both of those. Those are mutually exclusive. The inventors identified the Willems reference in that invention disclosure. And I certainly did not mean to say that what they meant by identifying Willems in response to question 3C was undisputed. It was disputed, and in fact, the special master accepted neither Optium's position nor EMCOR's position regarding precisely what the inventors meant by identifying Willems in response to that question. The special master came up with a third view. Now, it seems to us that manifestly evidences that there is a dispute about what the inventors meant. The court should have had a trial to hear from those inventors on cross-examination, perhaps in a bench trial, to ask those inventors questions itself and assess their credibility. And the same with respect to the attorneys. The court should have had a trial to consider whether it finds credible the attorney's view that we don't remember. These are the sorts of things, many of the questions Your Honor asked, should have come out at a trial, but Optium did not get the opportunity. It was denied the benefit of reasonable assumptions being made in its favor based on the facts that it presented, and denied the opportunity ever to present these matters at a trial where a court could assess credibility, determine clear and convincing evidence of materiality, is that there? Clear and convincing evidence of intent, is that there? And then, at its discretion, balance the equities and decide whether that amounts to inequitable conduct. The court should have had a trial to do that.
How do you respond to the argument on FMC that was just made before counsel sat down?
I'm sorry, which precise?
Inference upon inference upon inference.
Well, I don't think that it is. I mean, they have said the inventors disclosed Willem. They must have, if they disclosed it at all, not to the patent office, it was to the lawyers. That's not an inference. EMCOR can't say it's an inference that the lawyers got that. And, in fact, Dr. Logan testified that he gave it to Mr. Priskow, the attorney. And I don't think it's disputed that the invention disclosure with the attached report went to the patent attorneys, though it's in the record, in the brief. So I don't think that's an inference at all. And at that point, the question arises, for the attorneys then to say why didn't you disclose it? And you can't fight off, you can't insulate potentially an act of bad faith and an inequitable conduct commission. You shouldn't be able to insulate that simply by saying, I don't know, I don't remember. And I think then at that point it is reasonable if the other subsidiary facts, high materiality, knowledge of high materiality, and non-disclosure. If those facts are met, you should not be able to insulate your conduct by saying, gee, I don't remember.
Any more questions?
Thank you
okay.
very much, Charles.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Thank you. Mr. Castanis, the case is taken under submission.
All rise.